before Josh left them to their stories. He needed to get some fresh air, so he snuck out the back, closing the fire door behind him, and just stood in the shadows, breathing in the fresh air.
"All getting a bit emotional for you, eh, cuz?"
said a voice from shadows.
"Jesus Christ," Josh said. "You scared the crap out of me."
He fell back against the wall, laughing. It was a nervous laugh, full of relief that the thing in the shadows didn't mean him harm.
"Oh, sorry, that wasn't my intention. After Gramps' speech in the church, I thought maybe he was right, you know? It's not our war. We should get to know each other. I mean, until today I didn't even know I had a cousin."
He still didn't step out of the shadows. Josh heard a curious clicking sound. It took him a moment to realize it was Lockwood's tongue on the roof of his mouth. "I'm not sure we are cousins," Josh said. "Not in the strictest sense."
"Well, we're blood. I mean, you just have to look at us."
And so saying, Lockwood eased away from the wall, the shadows relinquishing their hold on him. The likeness was disturbing. He was right. There was no denying the genetic blend behind their faces.
"And apropos of blood, do you know anything about this bad blood between your great-grandfather and mine?"
"That's right, isn't it? The great pa.
It all sounds very mysterious."
"Not much," Josh said. "It was about a girl."
"Isn't it always?"
"Eleanor Raines."
"Pretty name. And I'm guessing your great-grandmother, then?"
"Nope. I'd never heard of her until this morning. My great-grandmother's sister."
"Oh, now that sounds like a scandal."
Something stopped Josh from telling his new cousin everything he knew. Instead, he blew out an exaggerated sigh and shrugged.
"Eleanor was the love of his life.
There was some big falling out between Isaiah and Seth, and that was it. The family split. Isaiah turned his back on the family, became a Raines, and my family was born."
"Oh, what a tangled web. Families, eh?"
"Families," Josh agreed. Lockwood stubbed out the cigarette he hadn't been smoking, and ground it out under his foot.
"Amen,"
he said. Josh shook his head. "But, like your grandfather said at the funeral, it's not on us, is it? There's no need for it to define the next 90 years of our family."
"Agreed,"
Lockwood said, inclining his head slightly as he looked at Josh, weighing up what to say next. Josh wasn't sure Lockwood believed him when he said he didn't know what the feud was about, but couldn't see why it should concern either of them. Like he said, it was 90 years ago, and that is a hell of a long time for old grudges to smolder on.
"Anyway, look."
Lockwood held out a hand for Josh to shake.
"I just wanted to say I'm sorry for your loss. I really am."
"Thank you," Josh said, taking the proffered hand. "I don't even know your name."
"Seth,"
he said.
"Yeah, looks like we're not the most original family when it comes to naming our offspring. It's just a curse I have to bear. Thankfully, no one remembers the old bastard these days. Anyway, by all accounts, your grandfather was a good sort. I can't begin to imagine how it'd feel to lose Gideon. So, you know," he said.
He let go of Lockwood's hand. Those were the last kind words that the pair would ever say to each other. Not that Josh realized that at the time. His cousin turned to walk away, but stopped on the edge of the shadows and turned to look back at him.
"Hey, nah, it's nothing. Forget it."
"What?"
"It's stupid. Don't worry about it. I was just wondering if the old guy left you anything. You know, a memento. Like I said, it's stupid. I just keep thinking about Gideon and wondering what I'd want of his to remember him by."
Josh's hand moved instinctively toward the letter in his inside pocket before he could stop it. But rather than pulling back and making it obvious, he carried on and pulled out Boone's battered silver tobacco tin.
This, he said, holding it up in the brightness of the security light for him to see. I think he was trying to get me killed. The joke fell flat. Lockwood left him alone in the dark. 4. The Rushes.
He's lying, Seth Lockwood said, and rather badly at that.
So what do we do?
The old man in the passenger seat asked. The degenerating nerves in his right cheek twitched, making it look as though he was struggling not to smile.
We bring in the Rushes, Seth said.
The what?
You'll see soon enough.
I don't want to spoil the surprise. We're getting into Boone's house, and we'll tear it apart if need be. We're going to find what he left behind. Anything that leads back to Glasstown, we destroy. It's as simple as that.
Remember, he's just a kid. He's not part of this.
Don't go getting sentimental on me, Sunshine. We do what we have to do. Whatever it takes. That's how we survive. Sometimes we even go so far as to enjoy it.
And don't bother trying to pretend you've never enjoyed causing pain. I'll recognize this in you. We're kin.
They were parked at the side of the road, 3 streets away from the back of the Scala, overlooking the ruin of the old Latimer Road cinema. It had been a long time since any celluloid gods had entertained on that particular silver screen. It had been almost 30 years, in fact, since the last Saturday morning picture show. Given the value of prime real estate in the heart of London, the land itself must have been worth a not-so-small fortune, regardless of the fact the building was a death trap. But still the old cinema stood abandoned and slipping ever more into decay without any sign of redevelopment. That might have surprised the casual observer, but a little digging into the right places would have revealed the name on the freehold as one Gideon Lockwood, the sale having gone through at the price of a peppercorn the week the old cinema owners filed for bankruptcy. More digging would have unearthed articles about the incessant vandalism the old Latimer Road cinema had been subjected to, including 2 attempts at arson, which suddenly stopped after ownership changed hands. A suspicious mind might draw certain conclusions from that evidence. There were reasons the Lockwoods had wanted the old cinema, of course. There were always reasons. Seth took 2 things from the glove compartment, a box of matches, and what looked like a Victorian wind-up toy.
"What on earth are you doing?"
Gideon Lockwood asked as his ageless father turned the carousel. He saw the flicker of movement within the inner circle of mirrors that lined the carousel.
"It's a praxinoscope, an early projection device. It is called Damiola's Carousel, and was part of the Illusionist stage show, and quite unlike any zoetrope that came before or after it. Just sit back and watch. There are different ways to put the frighteners on guys now. Like this."
The old man's cheek twitched again. His fingers had the same flutter, a sure sign that the disease was spreading. It made him look even weaker than he was. Seth Lockwood had no stomach for weakness.
"Now do not fight me, boy, or disease won't be what kills you."
He planted the carousel on the dashboard, fitting a paper with a woman's silhouette cut from it onto the drum, and turned the small handle through 7 revolutions until it spun under its own momentum. Then he teased a match from the box and struck it, holding it in the center of the carousel as it turned. He opened the carousel's hood, and a moment later the flickering matchlight was projected into the middle of the street in front of them. Slowly, with each rattling revolution of the carousel, a stuttering silhouette began to take shape within the light. 2 more turns of the handle, and the flickering frames settled on the shape of a woman, though her face was horribly blurred from the carousel's erratic motion. It didn't become any clearer even though the image became more and more substantial, until an actual woman appeared to stand in the middle of the road. Though as the clouds shifted to reveal the moonlight streamed through her, undoing the illusion. The match burned out, and the carousel came to a stuttering stop. She didn't disappear. The woman conjured up by the carousel turned to face them. Her face remained a featureless smudge, but every other detail was in sharp focus. She wore a white dress that billowed around her knees and accentuated her movie star bust. She had a blonde bob cut short above her shoulders. There was no color anywhere on her. She was a stark black-and-white projection made real in shades of gray.
"Meet the Rushes," Seth said.
He opened the car door and clambered out. He walked up the middle of the road to stand face to face with his invocation. In the car, Gideon couldn't hear what his father said to his creation. He didn't need to. He knew he was filling its head with orders and sending it out to hunt. He couldn't bear to look at the apparition. It did strange things to him. It stirred things inside the old man he'd been sure were long since dead. After a moment, the conjuration seemed to shift ever so slightly, causing the moonlight to diffract, and moved off, not running, not walking, but seeming to blink in and out of existence with each jarring step, because her new body lacked all the frames it needed to move smoothly. And then she was gone. Seth Lockwood walked back toward the car.
"She's off hunting," he said, clambering back into the driver's seat. "She will tear Boone's house apart. If there is something to be found, she will find it and bring it to us."
"What is that thing?"
"I told you."
"Not its name. I mean, what is it?"
"It's from that place. That's all you need to know. Think of it as a dream, if that helps."
"It doesn't."
"An ancient spirit, a thing of the mist, a demon, a succubus, eater of souls. There are lots of names for what she is."
"Dear God," Gideon said. "You've turned that thing loose to feed, haven't you?"
"I'm just protecting what I love, son, like anyone would."
"Can you control it?"
Gideon Lockwood shook his head at the sheer, staggering stupidity of what his father had just done.
"Well enough. She has Joshua Raines' scent."
He held up the dog end of Rizzler rolling paper and a few tufts of burnt tobacco that Josh had stubbed out before entering the church that afternoon.
"She won't fade out until she has finished her duty to me. I didn't lie. The feud ends now.
Joshua Raines is the last of Isaiah's line. I will not lose Eleanor. Not now. Not after all this time.
I will not stand by and watch the Duomas around Glasstown fail one by one until any idiot can stumble upon our haven and take her away from me. I have sacrificed everything. I will not let Isaiah win. The bastard is dead. If Joshua Raines has to die for Isaiah's hold over me to be laid to rest, then so be it. It is a price I am willing to pay. By the time I am through, I will have scoured every last recollection of his damned bloodline from the world. There won't be a living soul that remembers so much as his name, never mind his obsession with Eleanor. He won't win. He can't."
And there, in that last confession, Gideon Lockwood heard the depths of his father's madness. He didn't understand half of what was happening. Words like Duomas meant nothing to him. What he did understand was the intensity of his father's hate. The same emotion had fueled most of his adult life. The rest of it came down to one thing. Damiola's magic, whatever it was failing, and Glasstown was coming undone. Seth would do anything to stop that from happening, including murder. 5. White Noise. Josh didn't go back inside. He couldn't face the noise and the heat, and the smell of too many people crammed in too close together drinking. But more than anything, he couldn't face any more sympathy. Instead, he decided to sneak off. He figured Boone would forgive him, even if his mother wouldn't. Real life was going to kick in soon, a day or two at most, and then it'd be back to the office in Soho. and the endless phone calls to strangers trying to sell them ad space in a magazine going not so slowly out of business. There was nothing more soul-destroying than dialing number after number, reading the script, and trying to inject some sort of life into it all. Meeting his cousin had thrown him. There was something about the guy he didn't like. It wasn't just that he was slick, smarmy, or any other unpleasantly greasy adjective that came to mind when he thought of second-hand car salesmen. It was more fundamental than that. There was just something inherently off about him. Of course, it was quite possible his judgment had been clouded by the fact that he was a Lockwood. Old hatreds ran deep, even when you just inherited them. People said names had power. The Lockwood name certainly did. And that had nothing to do with the arcane or mystical, and everything to do with cricket bats to the knees, coshes made from socks stuffed with pool balls and wrapped around the side of someone's skull, shivs in the base of the spine, and other makeshift weapons of pain. They were particularly good with pain. Josh rolled another cigarette. There was an art to it that he hadn't quite mastered, but then he'd never been a smoker. Since Boone's death, it had felt like a way of being connected to the old man. So he lit the straggly roly and sucked on the end of it, allowing himself to remember his grandfather. He coughed out smoke and fell back against the wall, half laughing at the ridiculousness of it all, and flicked the cigarette end over end toward the trash. He walked away, leaving the faint strains of conversation and laughter behind. The Rothery at night was a curious animal at the best of times. Tonight was not the best of times. He walked with his hands stuffed into his grandfather's pockets, head down, from one puddle of streetlight to the next puddle of streetlight. He could hear the forlorn cries of a siren somewhere in the distance, and the roar of a car racing around the fringe of the estate. It didn't take any great imagination to link the two together. Boy racers out for a joyride. He used the narrow alleyways between the terraces to cut across the municipal park, without having to so much as set foot on a blade of grass, and then cut through the garages and up the hill toward home. He saw kids coming out of the sports hall, sweaty from football practice. There'd been something about one of the lads in the magazine recently, a local interest piece. He was supposed to be the real deal, a genuine talent. The route avoided the shops and shaved about 10 minutes off the walk. Long before he made it to the door, he saw the peculiar flickering light through the chink in the curtains of the downstairs window, like someone had left the television playing to itself. He tried to think back, but it wasn't like they'd watched anything for days. The house had been a silent shrine since Boone's death. Josh stopped at the end of the drive. He could just make out a darker shadow around the door jamb where it was slightly ajar. He knew he'd locked up. Someone was in there. Some little bastard was robbing them on the day of his grandfather's funeral. Something inside Josh snapped. Instead of calling for help, he ran to the door and flung it open, making as much noise as possible as he entered, hoping that it would scare the intruders off. Perhaps it would have, had they been kids looking to get in and out to make a quick score. But this was no simple smash and grab. The downstairs rooms looked like a war zone. The contents of every drawer had been turned out. Papers, bills, magazines, and everything else that had been accumulated over far too long was scattered across the carpet. The furniture had been overturned. The back of the couch peeled away to expose the wooden frame and springs beneath the thick corduroy. Glasses and ornaments from the dresser added to the debris. A tiny porcelain dancer in pieces beside a Herefordshire bull and a Shire horse. The horse's matchstick cart was in splinters. Broken frames were discarded on the floor, beside the torn photographs that catalogued generations of their family, that had been torn out of them, and cutlery glittered like treasure amid the ruin of their lives. Josh's heart hammered wildly as he reached down for a knife, not that it was sharp enough to do anything more than butter someone to death. He realized that the television, the Blu-ray and satellite decoder and all the other expensive electricals were untouched, and he saw Boone's watch amid the mess. It was an old gold fob watch and chain, probably worth £300 or £400, easily portable, simple enough to sell on. This wasn't just wanton vandalism. They were looking for something. But what? He picked his way through the mess, calling out,
I know you're in here. I don't want to hurt you. Just go and I won't call the police. I won't chase you. I won't even look to see who you are. Just go and we can forget all about this.
No answer. He walked through to the kitchen. The ransacking was every bit as thorough in there, with every drawer turned out, crockery broken on the linoleum floor, the plant pots in the window overturned and spilling their dry dirt across the sill. But the room was empty. He heard something upstairs, the groan of a floorboard above his head. Josh gripped the handle of the knife as tightly as he could and walked back through to the hallway and the phone. He dialed 999 and interrupted the operator as she asked which service he required.
There's someone here,
he whispered urgently.
Upstairs. I can hear them.
There's someone in the house with you?
A break-in.
And they're still in the house?
I can hear them moving about.
She confirmed the address with him, then said,
Listen to me carefully. Don't say another word. I'm dispatching officers to your location. They will be there in less than 5 minutes. Do not draw attention to yourself. Go outside. Wait for them. Do not remain in the house. Do not take any unnecessary risks. Let us do our jobs. Property can be replaced. The most important thing is that you do not put yourself in harm's way. Do you understand?
Josh could hear the intruder moving around upstairs.
I understand, he said,
laying the handset back down beside the phone. He could still hear the operator telling him to go outside now and wait. But instead of doing what he was told, he climbed the stairs one step at a time, listening at each one until he was at the top. He could see the weird flickering light bleeding out from under the door of what had been Boone's bedroom. He thought about going back downstairs, doing what he had been told, and going outside to wait for the patrol car. But 5 minutes might as well have been an eternity. They were in the room now, rifling through Boone's stuff. He kept thinking about Lockwood and how he'd asked if Boone had left him anything. It was too much of a coincidence that within an hour of that, he'd returned home to find the place being torn apart. Wasn't it? Isaiah's letter had promised a wealth of material from his obsessive investigation into Eleanor Raines's disappearance. Did the Lockwoods know about that stuff?
Of course they did,
he thought bitterly. They were wrapped up in this and had been from the very start. All that talk about a clean slate, about new beginnings, it was all rubbish. Life wasn't random. It was a weave of complex events, causes and effects, both on a personal and an impersonal level. Things didn't just happen. Lockwood hadn't just happened to be outside the Scala. His cousin had been lurking in the shadows, playing lookout. Gideon Lockwood had sent some of their thugs around to hunt for Isaiah's legacy while they knew he was at the wake. It was the one time they knew for sure Boone's house would be empty. The thought scared him. Really scared him. He'd grown up hearing stories of what they were capable of, and always thought them exaggeratedly tall tales. But suddenly risking coming face to face with the reality was so much more frightening than any gossip, no matter how colorfully violent. He knew he should have waited outside like the operator said, and on any other day he might have. But not today. He wasn't going to run scared today. Boone hadn't been in the ground more than a couple of hours. This was his home, and anything Boone had left here, he'd left for Josh to find, not some bastard in Lockwood's pocket. Josh crept across the landing. He stopped outside the door to his grandfather's room and listened. He could hear them tearing the place apart. Josh pushed the door open. The room was a mess. Sheets had been stripped from the bed, the mattress overturned, and clothes pulled from the wardrobe and strewn about. In the middle of it all, the source of the weird light, a woman in a dress so white he could barely stand to look at it. She had her back to him and was tearing into a pillow, though what she hoped to find inside it he had no idea.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
Josh said. The adrenaline flooded out of his system at the sight of a woman, where he dreaded seeing a bunch of hoodie-wearing thugs or old-school bald-headed overweight Doc Martens-wearing bother boys. The relief was short-lived. She straightened up slowly, seeming to flicker with each jerky movement, hands still deep in the foam of the pillow, and turned to face him, but without a face that was next to impossible. Where there should have been eyes, there were dark hollows. Where there should have been cheekbones, brow, and nose, they were smudges of light and dark that blurred together, as though her creator had tried to erase her from the face of the world. The tear of her mouth opened, and a sound like the crackle of white noise emerged. Josh dropped the knife. He stepped back a half step, shaking his head. She didn't come into focus. Every movement was jerky and incomplete, like a film reel skipping over vital frames. A dark smear opened in the middle of her face, and she cocked her head to the left. He realized she was sniffing him out, drawing his scent down into her like some kind of ethereal bloodhound. And then, when she had it, she came at him, bursts of static crackling out of the tear in her face. Outside, he heard the distant wail of sirens. The police were still streets away. The woman in the white dress rounded the bed. For just a second, her face seemed to come into sharp focus, and he knew her. How could he not? She had one of the most famous faces of the 20th century. Blonde bob cut to her shoulder, high cheekbones, pencil-thin arched eyebrows, sharp nose, and rich red adulteress's lips and smoky eyes. Myrna Shepherd, one of the first beauties of the silver screen, who had smoldered beside the likes of Louise Brooks, Greta Garbo, Hedy Lamarr, Faye Ray, and Mary Pickford. The poster of Wallflower Girl was a student dorm room classic. The poster had hung on the wall above his first girlfriend's bed for all the months they had been together. The look the photographer had captured in her eyes was anything but platonic, and had caused thousands of young men down the century to fall in love with an impossible-to-live-up-to girl. Vicky, an earnest, intellectual, tragically hip girl trying to work out the woman she was going to become, never had a chance. How could she have, when every time he made love to her, he was looking up into Myrna Shepherd's eyes? The woman in white was a young shepherd, but unmistakably and impossibly her. The Hollywood icon stood in Boone's cramped little bedroom in the middle of the Rothery, the same Hollywood icon that had been buried in a cemetery in Los Angeles for 20 years. Josh remembered the line from Isaiah's letter when he confessed that he'd seen Eleanor Raines again, or thought that he had.
She hadn't changed, not in the slightest. She was still the same heart-stopping beauty.
And here he was, face to face with another woman who hadn't changed in the slightest from that same golden age of silent cinema. Another actress who still wore the face she had during the 20s. It had the quality of a dream, at once elusive, chilling, and impossible to wake from. Alone in a bedroom with one of the world's first true sex symbols, and there was nothing erotic about any of the thoughts tumbling blindly through his mind. Josh tried to back up a step, moving toward the doorway. Myrna Shepherd moved another juddering step toward him, closing the gap to touching distance as she reached out for him. Another burst of white noise crackled out of her mouth, but this time he could have sworn he heard his name hidden within the rush of static, full of sibilant hiss. And then she was gone, those beautiful, impossible features burning up like a strip of celluloid under the intense heat of the projector's lens, and the faceless woman stood before him again. A smell, a fragrance he couldn't name, filled the cramped bedroom. She reached out a hand for his face, to make a connection. The tear in the featureless plane of her face opened, the crackle of static, desperate, hungry. The sirens were louder, but still too far away to help him. Josh didn't hesitate. He ran. Out of the room, down the stairs, through the door, and out of the house. Away from the woman whose face had hung from his girlfriend's wall, and into the darkness. 6. Myrna Shepherd's Eyes. Responding to a call in the Rothery was a case of taking your life in your hands at the best of times, and a late-night call promising a burglary in progress could never be described as the best of times. Police Constable Julius Gennaro, who had been saddled with the unfortunate moniker of Julie from his first day on the job 18 months ago, and his partner Hugh Carter, known forever as Taff, pulled into the cul-de-sac where the open door of Boone Raines's house was backlit like something from a Spielberg movie. They rolled to a stop outside the house. The headlights lit the front up like a Christmas tree.
15 minutes,
Taff grunted. That was how long until the shift change. 15 minutes, and they would have been back in the station, and the call to 11 Albion Close would have been someone else's problem. 15 minutes, and their lives would have been oh so very different. And in Taff's case, longer. He reached up and killed the siren. He hated the damned noise. Every copper on the beat did.
Come on then, Julie. Let's go be heroic for a few minutes.
The big Welshman said as he unclipped the seatbelt and opened the door. Taff wasn't in good shape, and it wasn't just a few extra pounds, either. It was all about discipline, or the lack of it, temptation and excess. Taff Carter was just a boy who couldn't say no, and as he'd always known, it would be the death of him. He eased his girth out of the car and straightened the baton on his belt, ready for trouble. There was always trouble. It was just part and parcel of their everyday lives. It was getting worse, though, and had been for the last few years. The streets were nastier than they had been in a long time. Brexit had given people an excuse to revel in their prejudices. Race crime was up. Religious hate crime was up. Violent crime was up. Criminal damage was up. But it was okay because the vicious little bastards had got their country back. There was an edge of brutality to it that hadn't been there when he'd started out walking the beat 30 years ago, in that weird time between the '70s brutality and the '90s new police. It wasn't just that people were more desperate now. They'd always been desperate if you looked far enough down the social ladder. Put simply, if they wanted something now, they'd take it. It didn't matter if they were coveting mobile phones, laptops, fancy designer trainers, or cars. If it caught their eye, nothing and no one could stop them from taking it, especially not a fat old policeman like Taff. Gennaro closed the passenger door. He was younger and fitter than his partner, and still idealistic enough to think that he could make a difference, so his name was always the first up on the notice board for outreach programs and community policing days. 3 nights a week he volunteered down at the youth club, playing table tennis and pool with kids who 2 hours earlier were out on the rob in Taff's bitter, cynical world. Julie's was different. Where Taff saw shit, he saw the chance for things to get better, and Julie always saw the best in people when they were trying to make their lives better.
What do you make of it?
Taff pulled the baton from his belt and extended it, ready for the worst.
Keep your eye on the car.
The big Welshman walked down the drive to the open door. Gennaro walked to the curb and waited in that no-man's land between the vehicle and the crime. This was always the worst part of any call, not knowing what they were walking into. It wasn't anticipation. That was the wrong word. It was apprehension. Until they crossed the threshold, they had no way of knowing what waited on the other side of the door. Anything was possible, right up until the moment it wasn't. There was something disquieting about the peculiar light spilling through the open door of number 11 Albion Close. But before unease could mutate into dread, Gennaro saw a woman emerge from the house. The light left her looking as though a thin gauze had been draped across her face like a veil, but even so her bob of blonde hair and smoky eyes, made stark by dramatic makeup, was hauntingly familiar. He felt like he'd seen her somewhere before. But that wasn't his first thought as she came through the door. His first thought was, she's far too beautiful for the Rothery. And she was. She was uncomfortably beautiful. Taff retracted his baton and clicked it back onto his belt, an eager smile spreading across his chapped lips.
Everything okay, love?
Taff asked as she walked toward him. Julius Gennaro couldn't hear her response as she leaned in close, but she seemed to sniff at Taff Carter's neck. He was sure he heard the sharp huff, huff, huff of her breathing. Instead of dispelling the unease, the sight of the woman, dressed for the red carpets of Hollywood, not the feral streets of the estate, only served to heighten it. There was a long moment when he felt sure she was more dangerous than any gang kid, but he couldn't have said why. And then the sharp staccato crackle of the radio clipped to his belt broke the tension, and she was just a beautiful woman on her own, and they were her white knights. Not that she needed rescuing. The woman turned her face toward Gennaro and walked away from Taff Carter without another word. She moved with a curious, faltering grace. A weird flickering interrupted each step she made. Gennaro found it hard to focus on her, but at the same time couldn't take his eyes off her. He knew the woman, he was sure of it, but couldn't place where he had seen her before. With no thought for personal space, she leaned in close, her nostrils flaring as she sniffed around the young policeman's throat, like she was sniffing out his pulse. He felt her lips against his skin. She had lips like clay. Julius Gennaro shivered. It was the kind of shiver that would have had his second-generation Italian mother saying someone had walked over her grave. And then she moved on, sniffing at the night air, and he was left feeling like he'd just lost something precious to him. Neither of them followed her as she walked down the middle of the road and out of the cul-de-sac, but both watched her every step of the way. She drifted between the pools of streetlights, flickering between the bright light and night as she went. The night was colder than he remembered it being when he'd clambered out of the car.
"What did she say to you?"
Gennaro asked Taff Carter, as the big man shuffled back up the drive toward him. Taff shrugged and shook his head. He looked lost, utterly and completely lost.
"I have no idea," he said,
touching a fat finger to his neck where the thick vein pulsed.
"I'm not sure she said anything. But did you see her? That's a woman to lose your mind for, my friend."
There was something in the way he said it, something that was echoed in his eyes that said he already had. Gennaro couldn't argue with him. She was something else. What, though? He wasn't sure.
"We should check the house out," he said,
realizing the eerie blue light had gone, leaving number 11 in darkness.
"No need, Julie. It's fine. False alarm,"
Taff assured him.
"Let's call it in and head home."
7. Secret Places. It was difficult to run anywhere when he had nowhere to run to. Josh thought about heading back through the estate toward the Scala and Boone's Memorial, knowing there were a few friendly faces there, at least. But the fact that there were friends gathered together in the bingo hall was enough to prevent him running that way. He didn't want to bring this thing to their door. So he kept his head down and ran hard, driving himself on, arms and legs pumping furiously, even as his lungs started to burn. Running and thinking was difficult. It was conditioning. He ran to empty his mind. But now he needed to think. That thing. It was a thing. His mind kept screaming, a thing, a thing, a thing, because it couldn't have been Myrna Shepherd. Not really. The rational part of his mind knew that was impossible. But what was it then? It had come to Boone's place looking for something. It had ransacked the house and was still in the process of tearing things apart as he'd interrupted it, so it couldn't have found whatever it was looking for. But that didn't mean it wasn't there. The only problem with that line of thinking was that Josh had lived in that house for most of his life. If there was something to be found, he would have found it before now, surely. So where else could Boone have hidden something? It wasn't as though the old man had a lot of secrets, but even as Josh thought that, he remembered something Boone had said to him once.
"I'll let you in on a secret truth, Sunshine. A man has maybe a dozen secret places during his life. It may start with a camp in the woods and end with a shed at the bottom of the garden as an old man, but there are a good few in between. If you ever find all of them, you'll truly know the man. But not until then.
They'd been talking about women at the time, and how much of yourself you were supposed to give to a relationship, because Josh had always found it hard after his dad's death to let anyone in. But could Boone have been talking about something else as well? A secret place where his true self lived. There were a dozen cars out on the road. They were the pack animals of the city. They hunted in numbers. He heard the deep-throated rumble of a gas guzzler, redlining it around the roundabout 3 streets over. Josh risked a backward glance. He couldn't see the woman in white, but he could see that lambent glow that emanated from within her, lighting up the sky like a low moon. It was hard to believe all of this was about a few clippings and assorted treasures of Isaiah's obsessive research into Eleanor Raines's disappearance. The woman had vanished over 90 years ago. Even if there was a crime there, it was almost a century old, and everyone involved was long gone. When Gideon Lockwood had said the past should stay buried, he was right. It really was time for a clean slate. There was no need for Josh and this new generation of Lockwoods and Raineses to get dragged into the feuds of their forefathers. But just because it hadn't been a thug in a hoodie upstairs didn't mean that his first instinct had been wrong. For all his talk about clean slates, Lockwood was behind the break-in. And what else tied Gideon Lockwood to Boone apart from Isaiah's papers? Josh gritted his teeth and ran on, the soles of his trainers slapping against the paving slabs as he cut across the road toward a narrow path that squeezed between the terraces, leading through to a back alley lined with plastic wheelie bins, overflowing with rubbish and torn bin bags. He didn't slow down. He was in good shape without being a gym rat, preferring to run through the park or swim on a Sunday morning to the endless repetition of weights. He cycled into Soho half the time, when he felt like taking his life in his hands. Drivers in London were a special breed of impatient on the cramped and crowded roads. They treated cyclists like an inconvenience to be squashed. His breath came in ragged gasps as he reached the end of the alleyway. Up ahead he saw the cut that led to the allotments, and realized he'd been running toward the sheds and the vegetable plots all the time. This was where his grandfather hid himself away from the world. Low-hanging telephone wires were strung like garrots over the entrance to the path. Despite the fact that it hadn't rained for 2 days, the ground beneath his feet was still muddy. The sides of the path were lined with thick hedgerows, a quintessential little slice of Britain in the middle of all of the concrete, with the plots themselves on the side of a steep bank that ran all the way down to the river, more than 300 feet below. Josh ducked under the telephone wires and slipped and slid down the bank, until he reached the red gate of Boone's old allotment. The vegetables had run to seed, and the hedges gone wild in the months it had been left untended. Rotten apples still hung on the trees in the middle of the tall grass. In the plot beside Boone's, the door of an empty pigeon coop rattled in the wind. Josh slipped through the gate. Boone's shed was at the far side of the field. It was up on paving slabs, so it didn't sink into the earth with the torrential spring rains undermining it every year. The door was locked with a heavy padlock. Josh didn't have the key. There were 2 small dusty windows, but neither was big enough for him to climb through, even if he broke them. It was easier for him to worry the entire hasp out of the wooden doorframe than try to break the lock. Even so, it took him the best part of 10 minutes to pry the door open and get inside, because he was a lousy Boy Scout and hadn't come prepared. It wasn't exactly an Aladdin's cave of treasures. There was an old grass-smeared lawnmower hanging up on a series of nails, and thick loops of orange power cables coiled beside it. Shears and hoes and spades and all manner of plant pots, both plastic and red clay, lined the workbench. There was an old vise and a pair of Wellington boots beneath it. There were saws and hacksaws with sharp teeth lying on oily rags, and beside a tea-chest that had been converted into a makeshift seat, a copy of a book his grandfather would never finish reading. Green Men and the Mythical Secrets of a Lost England. There were candles and a box of matches beside it. There was a bright red toolbox on the floor that was open, and inside it he could see an assortment of every screw and nail imaginable, scattered around various screwdrivers and spanners. What there wasn't, as far as he could see, was anything that might have hidden Isaiah's legacy. He closed the door and sank down onto the tea chest, cold and alone. He was tired of running around in circles, getting nowhere fast. He didn't risk lighting one of the candles. He didn't want the attention an errant light might have drawn. Josh had been looking at the set of keys hanging from a hook on the back of the door for a good 5 minutes before he realized what they were. He checked to be sure, but even before he measured the teeth side by side with his own, he was sure they weren't for the house on Albion Close. Could they be the keys to Boone's secret place? There was only one way to find out. He pocketed them. 8. Lonely Avenue.
"Hey, Julie, I'll drop you here if that's okay,"
Taff Carter said, pulling up beside the hunter's horns. The pup traditionally marked the end of the Rothery and the beginning of civilization. He didn't indicate as he slowed. An old woman shuffled down the street, struggling with a bulging plastic shopping bag. No doubt it was stuffed full of cigarettes, a bottle of something to make the pain go away, and comfort food. What else would she venture out for at this time of night? The police station was a 5-minute walk from the public house, and looked more like a prison than a haven.
"I've got a couple of errands to run. It might drag on a bit. Figure you'd want to get home as soon as possible, not tag along with me."
It might have sounded reasonable, but for the fact that in the 18 months they'd been partners, it was the first time they hadn't clocked off together.
"Do me a favor. Punch me out, would you?"
He handed his partner the keycard from his wallet. It was also the first time Taff Carter had asked his partner to break the rules and clock him out. One change of habits wasn't necessarily a red flag. Two could, at a stretch, be a coincidence. But given Taff's odd behavior back at the crime scene, he was already looking at the third and final warning sign. It was the rule of three. The devil was in the details. It took 3 changes in behavior before the old bullshit detector went into the red zone and alarm bells started to ring. That weird look in his eyes when he came face to face with the woman in white didn't count as a third thing by itself, but it all added up to something. What's exactly, Gennaro didn't know, but something rather than nothing.
"No problem," Gennaro said. "Catch you tomorrow, matey. Sleep well."
He pocketed his partner's keycard.
"You too, Julie."
Gennaro clambered out of the car and slammed the door behind him. Without thinking about what he was looking for, Julius Gennaro cast a quick backward glance in the direction of the Rothery, and for just a moment, the reflections made it seem like there were 2 moons in the sky back there. But the trick of the dark soon faded. Head down, he trudged along the lonely avenue toward the station. Taff watched him go. When Julie turned the corner and disappeared behind the creaking sign of the old pub, he eased out into the middle of the road, executing a careful 3-point turn, and headed back toward the hunter's horns. It was a few minutes after closing time when he pulled up outside the pub, but that didn't matter. Lockwood was expecting him. He didn't go in through the main door. He went around to the side and knocked twice, sharply on a boarded-up door. The walls on either side of it was a patchwork of whitewashed bricks and clever graffiti. The door opened a moment later. It was a young man, Lockwood's grandson, who answered.
"Ah, our bent bastard. Nice of you to grace us with your presence."
He stepped aside to let Taff inside.
"Don't call me that."
"Why not? That's what you are, isn't it? A bent bastard."
"I don't like it."
"I don't care what you like. But if it makes you feel better, I could just call you our cunt. How'd you like that? I mean, you open yourself wide for our money. So that's what you are, isn't it?" "Go fuck yourself, kid."
Lockwood smiled.
"Ah, so you've still got a bit of self-respect hidden in there somewhere, have you? Good. It's no fun if you're completely broken. Come in. Granddad's expecting you."
Taff followed Lockwood Jr. down a dank Regency wallpapered corridor to a heavy oak door that led through to the snug where Gideon Lockwood waited. The carpet was sticky under his feet. Lockwood stopped just short of the threshold.
Just remember, one day not too far away now, all this will be mine. You will be mine. Pleasant thought, isn't it?
Before Taff could answer, he opened the door. The old crook maneuvered his wheelchair around to face Taff as he entered the smoke-filled room. There were three untouched drinks on the table. Gideon Lockwood nodded toward one of them. Taff took his seat. There were cigarette burns in the upholstery. Like everything else inside the hunter's horns, it had seen better days.
You wanted to see me?
Gideon Lockwood reached out with a trembling hand for the brandy glass on the table. He hooked his fingers around the stem and raised it to his lips, savoring the rich flavor of the drink before he deigned to answer his pet policeman.
I did. I do. And no doubt I will again. Can't live without me, eh?
Taff Carter said with a good deal more bluster than he felt. This place gave him the creeps. It was like something out of a 60s gangster movie. He half expected to see the ghosts of Ronnie and Reggie Cray leaning against the bar, looking on approvingly as one of their kindred spirits put the frighteners on the copper.
I believe you responded to a call to a burglary on the Rothery tonight.
Taff nodded.
Nothing exciting.
Au contraire, the old villain said. It was quite exciting, actually. The thief was looking for something I would dearly love to lay my hands on, but she failed me. The object of her search is rather precious to my family. An heirloom, I suppose you'd say. It was taken from us many years ago, and we've just recently learned that the thief was none other than the much-loved and late of this parish, Boone Rains. That's where you come in, Mr. Carter. I want you to recover it for me.
We've known each other a long time, Mr. Lockwood. You know you can trust me, the Welshman said,
already rubbing his palms in anticipation of the silver that was about to cross them.
I know I can, Hugh. My grandson doubts your dedication to our cause, but I don't. I know exactly what your loyalty costs in pounds, shillings, and pence.
His smile was wry.
And that's what counts, after all, isn't it?
Taff didn't contradict him.
So what is it I'm looking for?
As I said, an heirloom. A piece of Damiola's glass.
Is that some kind of ornament? A necklace?
Not really. It's more like a custom-ground lens.
A lens? You mean like a contact lens, or for a camera?
Lockwood shook his head.
In principle, yes. But again, neither are terms I would use to describe it.
Okay. So how would you describe Dumwatsit's lens, then? I need to know what I'm looking for.
Damiola's glass.
Lockwood repeated the name slowly, as though he were talking to a child.
It's about the size of a cricket ball.
He demonstrated, fighting the shakes to put thumbs and forefingers together to make a rough circle.
But shaped like a disc rather than spherical, hence referring to it as a lens. You'll find it in a brass compact case.
Compact? Like a makeup case?
Lockwood nodded.
Okay. And what's so special about it? It can't just be sentimental value. No offense, but in all the years I've known you, Mr. Lockwood, you've never once come across as the sentimental sort.
People can change, Hugh.
Gideon Lockwood half smiled.
But its relative value is none of your concern. All you need to know is that it is precious to me. Bring it back to me, and you shall be rewarded handsomely.
So, not to put too fine a point on it, but where am I going to find this precious compact?
On a dead man,
Lockwood said.
Assuming he took it with him to the grave,
Otherwise, it could be anywhere. That is why I am paying you.
The old man reached into his jacket for his wallet and began to count out £500 in crisp fifties.
This should cover any incidentals you might incur.
What if I said I didn't want your money? Taff said, earning a snort of derision from Lockwood's grandson as he reached down for his own glass. He hadn't taken a seat at the table. It was about intimidation. By standing over them, he was exerting power, showing his dominance. Taff had to look up to him whether he wanted to or not.
I'd say I didn't believe you, but for the sake of argument. What do you want, if not my money? Let's open negotiations, Officer Carter.
The woman.
What woman would that be?
The woman in white. The one you sent to find the looking glass.
You want me to give you the woman? How's that supposed to work?
Just one night. That's all I want. One night with a woman like that. Taff was shaking. His tremors were more pronounced than Lockwood's, even without the old man's affliction. He struggled to master them.
Just say I could arrange it,
Gideon Lockwood said, waiting for the hope to register in the policeman's eyes. The eyes could never lie, he'd found, not when the temptation dangled in front of them was fashioned from desire.
What makes you think I would?
I've been good to you, Mr. Lockwood. Never seen you wrong. Looked out for your interests. Kept my colleagues off your back.
And you figure I owe you? Is that it?
He didn't want to say that, not out loud. But yes, that was exactly what Taff figured.
Ever heard the saying, be careful what you wish for?
One night, Taff said. That's all I want. Just one night with someone like that. Dear God, could you imagine? A slow smile spread across the young Lockwood's face. He knocked back the shot of whiskey in his own glass and slammed the tumbler back down onto the ring-stained table right in front of Taff Carter.
I could, but I don't think you can, he said.
Why? Because I'm overweight. A fat fuck like me would never get to have a woman like that go down on me. Do me a fucking favor. All I've got is my fucking imagination, Taff said bitterly. Just once, I'd like to have the real deal. So if it's all the same to you, fuck your money. I want the woman, and not just some whore you send around to my place. Her. I want her. I want her to fuck me like I'm Brad fucking Pitt and George Clooney rolled into one. And I want her to pretend she likes it. If you can get her to do that, I'll get the glass for you, and I'll get you anything else you want.
Well, then, I think we have ourselves a deal, Hugh,
the young Lockwood said, gripping his shoulder. His fingers were uncomfortable as they pressed deeper than they should, digging into the muscle.
I'll send her around to your place tonight.
You're right. You deserve it. And it's the very least I can do for you.
Thank you.
Oh, don't thank me, you bent bastard. You're going to get exactly what you asked for, because I am a man of my word. Words are important. But in terms of our little arrangement, it's purely business. Remember that. When you're lying back and trying to think of England. I hope she's worth it.
She will be.
Taff turned to go, then stopped and said,
one more thing. Don't push your luck, Taff. His name. This dead man who I'm looking for? Cadmus Damiola.
What kind of name is that?
An old one. It used to mean something around here.
9. Whiskey Dreams. When was a key not a key? It wasn't so much a metaphorical question as it was a metaphysical one, like the tree falling with no one to hear it.